Hi, welcome again to Red Flags Rising. My name is Mike Hunneke. I'm the co-chair of Hughes, Hubbard & Reed's Sanctions, Export Controls, and AML Practice Group. Today is Thursday, May 29th, just after 3 p.m. U.S. Eastern. With me is my good friend, Brent Carlson, director at the Berkeley Research Group. Brent, how are you doing?
Excellent. It's always great to be here with you, Mike.
So, Brent, BIS issued some guidance. We wanted to do a deep dive today into really what we think are the key elements that people need to appreciate about that guidance and what to do about it. I think this will be really valuable to our listeners, Brent, because we're seeing worlds collide in a sense. You have still the legacy framework of export controls being, yes, related to national security, but really process-heavy, administrative, civil fines, civil enforcement, colliding with the white-collar corporate enforcement world. We've certainly heard, as we've talked about many times on the podcast, Secretary Lutnick, other political appointees who are now in place at the Department of Commerce, talk about strong export controls enforcement being a priority. Secretary Lutnick intends for it to be a hallmark of his tenure as the Secretary of Commerce. In any type of white-collar enforcement environment, it's very important to discern the signals through the noise. And some of that noise may be coming also from the government, and it may be coming from that legacy perspective, that legacy background, especially in export controls. The historical dialogue, the normal framework in which people discuss these is highly technical, highly complex. But some of the messages are actually very simple and very straightforward. If you're not looking for them, and if you haven't come to this topic with experience in other white-collar enforcement areas, they may not jump out to you. Our listeners will remember that on May 13th, we published a podcast episode on end use and end user catch-alls. We usually think we're pretty good about looking around the corner and seeing what's coming next. On this one, we exceeded our own expectations in that that day that we published it, BIS issued three important documents announcing guidance and some policies, all of which really turned on the end use and end user catch-alls, specifically those related to WMDs and to military intelligence activities. On that podcast, we at least had time to put a little intro at the beginning explaining that this had happened and explaining how the podcast that followed was relevant. But Brent, we wanted to come back to that guidance in those policy documents and really explain to people what's important. You know, there's a lot that's happened and many different aspects of trade over the past 2 weeks. So Brent, what are we going to focus on today and what's important for people to double back and re-review from that May 13th guidance?
The key themes that run through all three of these documents that were issued by BIS on May 13th are catch-all provisions and knowledge. Knowledge is defined under the EAR, and that's a topic that you and I have been discussing and writing about for a very long time. I think it's very important to go back and look at these documents from BIS from that perspective, the catch-all provisions and then the knowledge. I'll talk first about the one that we're not going to focus on. The first one was the guidance on the application of General Prohibition 10 to the People's Republic of China Advanced Computing Integrated Circuits. This is really targeted for Huawei chips being sold abroad. It's an attempt to shut out Huawei chips from competing in these international markets that U.S. chips are going into.
Right, Brent. Certainly, if you are a data center provider outside of the United States and you are excited because you recently placed an order for these Huawei chips, be careful. The U.S. government's view is that you need a license to get them and to use them. Brent, what's another document that came out on May 13th?
Another one is the BIS policy statement on controls that may apply to advanced computing integrated circuits and other commodities used to train AI models. It's a short policy statement. It's only 2 pages long, but it's basically setting out the reasons why catch-all controls and knowledge apply in the exports, re-exports, and transfers of advanced computing ICs and related commodities, as well as foreign infrastructure as a service providers. These are the data centers providers anywhere in the world. This goes hand in hand with the document that we just talked about, shutting out Huawei. The policy statement sets the stage for the industry guidance to prevent diversion, which is what we're going to talk about in depth on this podcast, because the industry guidance to prevent diversion goes into the new due diligence expectations that BIS has for exporters. It talks about new red flags that they want companies to be considering in their due diligence as well. The key issue is coming to grips with what's really being said and what's not said in these documents that may cause some confusion. To get a grip around what are the key elements that BIS is trying to convey here, and where are some ways that could be underemphasized or misinterpreted by professionals in the industry?
Exactly, Brent. That is really the meat on the bone for any trade compliance professional in your day-to-day job. That document has the specific red flags you're supposed to be looking for. That document has what it expects you to evaluate when you're doing due diligence, when you're looking at the information you receive back, presumably when you inquire about some of those red flags that are mentioned.
Underlying all this are the national security concerns that the United States has, especially toward the People's Republic of China and the Chinese Communist Party there. These jump out at the beginning of these documents. We talked about national security with Dana White on our last podcast. The reason for this policy statement and this new industry guidance from BIS is right at the top, where it says BIS has determined that advanced computing ICs and commodities subject to the AR for training AI models have the potential to enable military intelligence and weapons of mass destruction end uses in country group D5 countries, which includes China. That's a pretty heavy statement. That's a pretty heavy purpose. This gets into some of the clarity in the language, or lack of clarity in some of the language, where people were maybe not coming into this from a white collar perspective or understanding the full national security implications behind this may get lost a little bit. When BIS uses these terms, weapons of mass destruction and military intelligence end uses related to the PRC, that means something.
Anyone interested in this discussion needs to go back and listen to episode 13 with Dana W. White as our actually first ever guest on the podcast. It was exactly her point. The United States is not guessing from its perspective. It is not engaging in the discussion of hypotheticals. For the Department of Commerce to include statements like this in a public document, it has to be the result of long deliberation across multiple parts of the U.S. government, including the U.S. intelligence community, including the U.S. Department of Defense. They think they're being loud and clear about these risks. What I keep coming back to, Brent, is that even with something like this where the words are the same, everyone's reading the same words, we all bring to any discussion, to any topic, our own perspective. We perceive reality through our own eyes. I still think there is a legacy perspective that doesn't see the potential danger to U.S. companies and to U.S. exporters, or frankly, to non-U.S. companies to whom the export controls would apply, whether it's under a foreign direct product rule or because there's certain people working on certain things. I don't think people fully appreciate how this looks to someone like Dana White, who we spoke to the other day. From their perspective, they're screaming from the mountaintop that there are really serious concerns here backing these things up. It is unfair, but the perspective that matters in terms of, will you get an outreach visit? Will you get an administrative subpoena? Will the FBI be there with BIS? How will a corporate settlement look? All of those topics, the government is going to approach from the perspective of, we have been issuing guidance for a long time now, indicating these are serious national security issues.
In these documents, mentioning the potential end uses related to military intelligence and weapons of mass destruction triggers catch-all provisions in the AR. We see a lot of folks assume that export controls are built around technical thresholds. The way that these documents are written, it can be a little confusing for somebody who has that perspective and is just going to look at, okay, what's the ECCN number? What's the export control classification number? My item, does it have that same ECCN? If not, okay, move on. Again, though, go back to those terms, military intelligence and WMD end uses, they trigger these catch-all provisions. Tell us a little bit what that may entail.
Well, Brent, although the government is coming to these guidance documents with its perspective, and while you and I are reading it coming from our perspective and our backgrounds, there is gratuitous use in these guidance documents of terms of art that the government is not specifically defining for you. The government might have taken the view, we don't have to explain that these are catch-all provisions because everybody knows that the references to nuclear, biological, or chemical, often collectively abbreviated as weapons of mass destruction, or WMD, are a catch-all provision. Everybody knows when we talk about military intelligence end uses that that is a catch-all provision. What they don't explain in the guidance is, well, what exactly does that mean and why are those two catch-all provisions being cited? To me, it's very significant that they didn't also include just the standard military end use catch-all provision. Now, why might not they have done that? Because that has specific limitations in that it only applies to items with certain export control classification numbers. Military intelligence, WMD, are not limited by items. So anything subject to the EAR, including a paperclip, you cannot ship to the Iranian biological warfare facility, for example. You cannot ship to any customer where you are aware, and we'll talk about aware in a second, of it being used by the military intelligence community within the PRC, for example. The other thing that strikes me in these documents is that they are repeatedly referring to knowledge within quotation marks. Every lawyer listening to this knows that that means that they are referring to knowledge as a defined term. How is it defined? It's defined in the Export Administration Regulations, 15 CFR 772.1, as not only actual knowledge, but also either reason to know, or, as we keep talking about, Brent, an awareness of a high probability of a violation of the EAR. For everything you would ever want to know about the high probability standard, where does it come from? What does it mean? Where else has it been used? How can it actually help me? People should go to our Fresh Looks website, where we have collected our NYU program on corporate compliance and enforcement blog posts and these podcasts. This is a driving concept through everything that you and I have done in the past 2 years, and it's right there. We'll include it in the show notes as we always do. But it's not random that they're putting knowledge in quotation marks. It's not random that they're citing to these particular catch-alls. They think they're being extremely clear. So it's important to keep that in mind as a company deciding what you think of this guidance, and as the trade compliance team within companies, what do we have to do with this and how are we going to do it?
This kind of gets us into the know your customer and red flag guidance that BIS has put out. And then also the additional red flags that BIS notes in this May 13th industry guidance document. Why don't we talk about some of the issues that we've seen around a legacy perspective in looking at that know your customer guidance, especially in terms of end-use certificates, customer attestations as to end-use.
Brent, for anyone dealing with these issues day-to-day, the question is always, how far do we have to go? Especially if you are making a product that, let's say, is ubiquitous, can be stockpiled by true distributors, economic distributors. By that, I mean people who really don't know the customer when they're buying it from you. They are taking the risk of finding a customer, right? And all of those scenarios, trying to decide how far to go and how to go about your due diligence is really tricky. And I think the reality is you have to decide how far you're going to go, but then you have to defend that. How do you defend that? That's one of the opportunities that the high probability standard presents, because you can then talk about whether it's specific countries, customers, items, whether there's a high probability of diversion. Now, you may have to do a little bit of work. You know, you can't just rely on the end-use certificates because everyone gets them for you. It's the new code of ethics. If you go all the way back to Sarbanes-Oxley in the early days of really meaningful anti-corruption enforcement in the U.S., it used to be a big deal to have your code of ethics. Well, that didn't actually solve anything because everyone had a code of ethics. It's becoming, unfortunately, as far as the end-use certificates go, a must-have but not an end-all to figuring out where your risks are.
Further along those lines, if we go into the supplement number 3 of part 732 of BIS's Know Your Customer Guidance and Red Flags, we've come across this statement that some people latch onto without really fully thinking about or considering the context around it. The statement is that in the absence of red flags, there's no affirmative duty upon exporters to inquire, verify, or otherwise go beyond or go behind the customer's representations. We've seen and heard this just shortened down to the short statement of there's no affirmative duty to inquire, verify, or otherwise go beyond the customer's representations. However, both above and below that particular line, it's like absent red flags and one cannot be self-blind. When we're looking at this, there's red flags that need to be sussed out as part of the due diligence process that go beyond whatever any sort of end-use certificate or flow-down compliance attestation would bring.
Brent, you're absolutely right that the KYC guidance is key, and it's something people looked to in the past for sure. What's interesting about it is that it predates, as far as I can tell, 1993. This is a very, very dated KYC guidance from a much different era. It's continued through the amendments to the EAR in 1996, where the high probability standard was added. It's continued to this day. I suspect that BIS is looking at it and evaluating whether they need to update it. They do cite to it. They do cross-reference it in the guidance documents that they issued on May 13th. When people are looking to find that line, how far do I go? There's a natural, totally understandable human inclination to latch onto something concrete. You're absolutely right to highlight that statement, but it's dangerous just to cherry pick that statement. If you read before it, it says, inquire, period. If there are no red flags in the information that comes to your firm, you should be able to proceed with a transaction in reliance on that information you have received. Then there's the sentence everyone quotes. And then, however, when, quote, red flags, end quote, are raised in information that comes to your firm, you have a duty to check out the suspicious circumstances and inquire about the end use, end user, or ultimate country of destination. So this is beyond ultimate consignee in some cases where the ultimate consignee is not the actual end user. The next paragraph in the same guidance is titled, Do Not Self-Blind. The paragraph after that is employees need to know how to handle, quote, red flags, end quote. So when you read this whole thing holistically, you have to be aware of the information that you have. And that can include not just the information on the shipping documents for the particular transaction that you're looking at. That's trade flows over time. Does it make sense where it's going? Brent, this leads us to the new guidance from May 13th, where BIS highlights exactly these type of additional things that it is expecting companies to do. The new transactional and behavioral red flags begin at the bottom of the first page, and they identify 11 of them. Now, some of them are still very formulaic in the sense that they're still very much paper-driven. They want to make sure that you're getting certain attestations and things like that. But some of them are broadly applicable, and they require you to know something beyond what might be in a typical end-use or end-user statement. Let's take, for example, the first one. The customer never received exports of advanced computing integrated circuits and or commodities that contain them prior to October of 2022. Well, that's not going to be on your end-use or end-user certificate. That requires you to look at your history of trade with this particular customer.
Part of it is a sort of gut check when going through these red flags and assessing that information that's come back from the potential customer or distributor. How would this look in 2020 hindsight? Or how would this look from the governor's perspective? How would this look in the Wall Street Journal or Bloomberg if it came out? We talk about where to draw that line, but it also has to be defensible if it comes under potential scrutiny later on down the road.
Exactly. And if we just keep going down the list, Brent, there's more of the same. Even if they did receive some of these same items before, has there been a spike since October 2022 in the quantity that they received? Do they have a residential address?
Along those lines, just look at this from a business perspective. When going into these data centers, these are big infrastructure projects. There's a lot that's going into it. This particular customer, do they have the wherewithal that could build and operate these things? I think that's a key element to look at. And if it's going through a middleman, well, why is the reason for that?
It's important to take away from this guidance, Brent, that it's creating an expectation of due diligence that is risk-based, that goes beyond what you would typically get in an end-use or end-user certificate, and requires the exporter to think from their perspective whether it makes sense. This new guidance also says it's a red flag when the ultimate delivery or installation address is unknown. It's a red flag where the customer refuses to disclose or provides incomplete information about the location of its headquarters. We've been talking, Brent, for several years now about assessing risk in a dynamic way, meaning changes over time. How have your trade flows changed over time, especially around key dates? October 22 is a key date because that's when new controls were put into place by the U.S. government in the context of these advanced integrated circuits. The same logic would apply to other key dates. Brent, the guidance concludes with some reminders about standard end use and end user certificates. There's a statement in there that I worry people are going to latch onto, and I think it's going to be dangerous to do so, which is saying that the suggestions that follow about end use certificates are not meant to replace what you have already determined best mitigates risk. What I think they mean, and what I think they will say they meant, if this becomes an issue, is that specifically in the context of the KYC process, they aren't telling you have to tear up all your existing end use or end user forms. That doesn't mean you don't have to do the red flags analysis that they just talked about for several pages, right? So be very careful in taking that sentence and cherry picking that sentence to undo everything that was above. What was above requires risk-based due diligence beyond the end use and end user certification. So Brent, let's ground all of this in terms of key takeaways and practical implications for trade compliance. This doesn't mean you have to do a massive investigation into every counterparty, but where you want to be if something bad happens, and 1 year from now, 3 years from now, whatever it might be, BIS, maybe FBI, maybe DOJ come and ask you, how did you get comfortable with the red flags that were present on a particular transaction. You want to have confidence that you can show through documentation how you selected on which counterparties you did extra due diligence. And if you decided at the end of that process to release a shipment or to send product to them, on what basis did you decide that the risks were mitigated? It's not a zero risk standard. It's a high probability standard, right? Who made that decision and how? This is very similar to what they wrote in the July 10th, 2024 guidance. If you're aware of red flags, we expect you to design a risk-based process to select where you're going to do enhanced due diligence, to document the results of that, and to document the decision-making process that you went through if you decided to ship it. What they also say there is if you can't on your own mitigate the risks and you want to ship it, then apply for a license.
You're absolutely right, Mike. I think one of the things to keep in mind as we're doing due diligence as companies and the compliance teams are doing the due diligence going forward is that these are signals of an enforcement wave that's going to be coming down the pike. So it's important to think about when companies make these decisions in terms of how and where they're going to draw that line on the due diligence, that it is going to be defendable when it comes under a high degree of scrutiny later down the road. The chances of a higher degree of scrutiny later down the road are only increasing.
So Brent, with that brings us to managing up. What managing up principle would you like to discuss today?
A classic, an oldie but a goodie, and it is trust but verify. Ronald Reagan used that quote when he was in arms negotiations with the Soviet Union at that time. It comes from a Russian proverb. But I think in this context, where we're dealing with new red flags, new expectations for due diligence, trust our customers, but verify the information you receive at the same time. Because it's going to be incredibly important now and going forward to be able to stand by your findings and your decisions based on those findings. Not doing so can open up significant liabilities for the company, its officers and directors, and its people, which means the legal and compliance team. So trust but verify and stand by it, and we can all sleep better at night and make our companies more successful.
Brent, well said as always. What we are seeing is trust but verify, but with somebody putting their thumb very much on the scale of verify. And verify is becoming all caps, underlined, bold, where there are those higher risks of violations of the AR. Does that mean you have to zero risk every transaction? No. What it does mean is that you need to have a process for identifying and evaluating where you, based on your customers, based on the countries they're in, based on the products and services you're selling them, might be seen as having a high probability risk, and then tailoring solutions to reduce that risk to those different circumstances. That concludes this episode of Red Flags Rising. Brent, as always, it was a pleasure. Be well.
Thanks, Mike. Be well.